Are we having fun yet, Jenny Kleeman? You still there?
Yes, I'm very glad to be back.
Excellent. We're loving this. Good. We're having so much fun. Let's talk about death. because if we're talking about tech innovations here and the impact on food, the impact on what we would consider to be normal human relationships, interpersonal communication, let's talk about this capsule we have the photo of on coasttocoastam.com, this very cool-looking purple sarcophagus, which I think any kid would want to climb into and pretend it's a rocket ship. But don't. Kids, don't. because it's a death machine.
Indeed. It is a suicide machine that promises to deliver a painless, peaceful, even euphoric death at the time of your choosing. That's what it promises. Whether or not it can deliver it is another matter. It looks very cool. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. And if you haven't seen the picture, it's on the website. But if you haven't seen it, it's kind of like a sort of spaceship / James Bond vehicle. It's a sort of long capsule that's tilted. It's got a door to it that opens like the DeLorean in Back to the Future.
Right.
And the thinking is you get inside it, you close the door, and within a couple of minutes, you die. And this machine is fully 3D printable. So all you need to do is get hold of the plans for it, and then you can print it yourself, and it's biodegradable, so you can be buried in it. And the machine is called Sarco, which is, you know, short for sarcophagus, because as well as being it's the coffin that kills you, basically. As well as being the means of your own death, it can be the thing that you're buried in, too.
Right. It kind of finally putting the cart before the horse, I guess we could say. It is cool looking. It looks like it almost looks like a torpedo, like a photon torpedo in Star Trek or something from Star Wars, or you would feed it into a tube and shoot it or whatever. So what's the tech inside that is creates the chain reaction which leads to death?
Well, I don't want to go into too much detail here, but essentially you die because of oxygen deprivation. So inside the chamber you breathe, but you're breathing a gas that isn't oxygen, which means that you don't feel out of breath. You're not gasping for air. You're breathing in and out, but there's not enough oxygen in the air. So you become hypoxic, and then you die.
Are they using nitrous oxide? Because then, like, you know, you'd be kind of have, like, little laughing gas, and then
Oxide is the oxide part of the nitrous oxide. There's oxygen in it. So that's not going to kill you. But yes, that would be a very euphoric way to die if only you could die.
Yeah. and the notion is that you buy this, or you get the plans for it, you make it, and you could make it now and have it in your living room for the next 20, 30 years. You don't have to use it right away. You just use it later, right?
The thinking behind this is for people who want total control over their own death. And you know, it's particularly, these kinds of approaches are very popular in states where there isn't a right to die enshrined in law. But the people, the main person who makes it, the person who designed it is a guy called Dr. Philip Nitschke. And he's a libertarian, and he thinks that doctors shouldn't be the gateway to an assisted death. In most places where the right to die is legal, you still have to get a doctor to sign you off and to give you the meds that will end your life. And this is something where anybody can say, I'm going to make the decision of when I die, and so I am going to own this device that will give me a peaceful death. And, you don't have to use it right away. You can have it in your home, have the plan somewhere. I mean, obviously, you'd need a pretty big garage to stash this thing if you were to print it out already. That's the thinking behind it, which sounds like it makes sense, really. It kind of makes intuitive sense to an extent. But then you remember that we do already have the means to give people a peaceful death at the time of their choosing, which are the drugs that are given in places where the right to die is legal. I would argue we just need to work out a way of making sure that people who want to end their lives have access to them instead of going to these ridiculous lengths of downloading this space capsule to transform you into, to transport you into the next dimension.
You can see the photo again at coasttocoastam.com. It's at the top of the page, first one in the carousel. So there are, I would think, I mean, if we look at this, maybe this is the new way that people will be executed in states that are still executing prisoners, because there's been a real problem, obviously, with electrocution, even with drugs that they've been using.
Yeah.
Several times that's gone badly. Some people are asking for the firing squad to return and whatever. It would seem like one of these and then be done with it. Just seal it up. You know, and then take it off to the pauper's field or wherever the person's going to be buried.
I think that's quite possible. And you know what? Nobody has said that to me yet. When I've been talking about this, nobody has brought this up, that this could be a means of people, on death row, that their lives being ended. I mean, part of the reason for the drive for this kind of technology is, with lethal injection, it's normally a combination of things. But the most common barbiturate given in a lethal injection is produced by a Danish company who stopped supplying death row facilities, I think, in 2011 for ethical reasons, which is why there have been so many problems recently that we can't get hold of the euthanizing drugs that would normally be used in those circumstances. But the thing is, if your dog needs to be put down and you take it to the vet, there is a substance that vets give people. There is something, when we imagine that there is a perfect death that's in a bottle somewhere, there is
right.
A substance. It's just very hard to get hold of. And when companies aren't providing that substance, this is where this kind of technology steps in.
I lived in a state here in Minnesota where it was legal for vets to come to your home and administer the euthanasia. And so when I had to have a very old dog put down, whom I adored, I got to hold him in my lap. He's not a very big dog. And I was able to rub his head, and I was able to see him into that passage. And I think it was very peaceful for him. There was nothing scary about it. And he just ceased to... He was doing so poorly that it was just hard to see him struggling to live. So it was good to see him be at peace. What's the success rate for this this purple sarcophagus of death?
Well, I should point out that what you see in that picture is a prototype that I don't think anybody has used it to die yet. They've done experiments where they can show that the level of oxygen drops enough to such an extent that you would die. Many other people have died using this method of ending their own life, a hypoxic death. There are other ways that you can... I really don't want to go into too much detail here. There are other ways that you can end your life without having a capsule like this. But it's not a very pleasant way to be found, for your family to find you. It's not a very dignified way to die. And I guess that's the kind of promise of this machine, is that it's making death a little bit glamorous, which is perhaps unfortunate, because I don't think death needs to be sold to people. But that's the lure of it. It's a death that you can completely control, that isn't messy, and that looks nice.
So, I that notion about it making easier for others, I think that's sweet. Although, in other places, I know doctors who would tell you that there's an informal system of assisted death that exists in just about. Any place where somebody is being cared for in their final stages, and they simply, start to deny food and water and then amp up the painkillers accordingly, and nature takes its own course on that. So, I mean, it's not I mean, it seems like there's already ways to do that, but at the same time, this would seem to this purple spaceship looking thing would appeal to a different market. It would appeal to somebody who is, you know, who wants that type of a death, where there may be a kind of nobility to this, and the idea of somebody being able to be transported, never leaving this and going directly to a gravesite somewhere, that might appeal to a certain psychographic more than a demographic.
I think you're very right there. And the person who invented it, he said, you know, this is for the sort of people who like the idea of maybe, you know, having a party, saying goodbye to everybody, climbing into the spaceship, saying, I'm leaving, you're staying, and ending their own life. I think there are not many people who fit into that category.
I
would be very interested in looking at the mindset and motivation of that kind of person.
Right.
That's quite a big ego to want to attend your own funeral. For me, this machine is a symptom of the problem, not a solution to it. And the symptom is we're all really scared of death. We all want to have control over it. And at the moment, people have very, you know, you talk about cradling your dog and having that kind of peaceful moment of tenderness with your dog. And
right.
I think for a lot of people, it's quite sad that their pets have that right, but they don't. We already have the means to provide that death. We just haven't found a way to frame laws internationally so that everyone can have it and vulnerable people aren't exploited.
I hadn't thought about the party aspect of that. It hadn't occurred to me that's how one, that would be part of the appeal of this. Maybe if you had some sort of Star Trek themed party and then you got in the photon torpedo and then if it didn't work, if something failed, at least you'd die of embarrassment.
Well, exactly. I mean, I spoke to the person who was kind of first in line to use it. She was an American woman who was, when they were kind of doing the press releases about this technology, they had quotes from her. And when I spoke to her, she said she was actually quite nervous because she has MS. She really wants to end her life. And when you've got to that point where you've really decided that this is it and you are going to die, this is the end of your life, the last thing you want is for something to go wrong, for you to kind of emerge from it and say, sorry, guys, I'm still here, or for you to have to deal with still being alive. You know, it has to go right every time because it is by definition a life or death decision. And that also kind of links in with this idea of competency and whether or not you're of sound mind when you make that choice to go into the machine. The machine has a kind of keypad next to it, which you're supposed to put a code in that will allow you to open the door, and there's going to be some automated psychometric test to check that you're of sound mind before you get that code. But ultimately, that machine can't tell if you're bereaved or drunk or if you might change your mind.
Exactly. Right. Very interesting. I can't imagine. I think that sounds like total bluster. I think that's something that they're just saying maybe to avoid difficult questions. You have a keypad that somehow indicates that you know why you're doing it at that moment, and that somehow would exculpate them, I guess, from legal blame or something.
I would argue that the entire process of having a 3D printable machine like this is about absolving the designers of responsibility for your death. Because if you download your own death and print it out, the people who invented it aren't culpable. But if they sell it to you, they're assisting suicide. So in fact, in the end, what this is all about is people evading responsibility for assisting suicide, I would say.
But isn't that interesting that maybe there's a kind of theme to this and the sex robots, too? It's sort of, it's more all about avoidance than it is about acceptance.
Absolutely. It's about entrepreneurs selling people the illusion of control over the uncontrollable, as in death and relationships, which you can never fully control. But instead of solving problems, they're making you turn away from them. They're circumventing those problems. They're giving you something to distract you from the problem, which is that death is scary and we don't really know how to deal with it. Or relationships are tough and insecure.
Very interesting. And we're talking with Jenny Kleeman and the book Sex Robots and Vegan Meat. And I kind of jumped over the birth sack thing to talk about the death sack, I guess, or the death pod that exists. But it was sort of fascinating, and it's on the website. You can go see it for yourself. And I think this is you know, maybe this is a good time to point out that we would like to think that we're evolving and that our solutions are getting sharper and smarter, when really, you know, this is back to the no future. We're not doing it right. We haven't figured it out yet. And these are just kind of weird paths that people are inserting in, maybe as placeholders, until we can really figure out what our values are and what we can make legal or whatever. And in the meantime, it's just what people are willing to make a buck off of.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my whole kind of argument, is what these bits of technology are shiny bits of kit that are there to distract us in a way. They're people saying, hey, you don't have to do the hard work of changing your behavior, of, you know, eating less meat or accepting compromise in relationships, or dealing with the fact that we all don't know when we're going to die and it's all a bit scary. That instead of doing that kind of work, which would really allow us to be more free and happier individuals if we could make those compromises and know ourselves better, they're saying, hey, don't worry, I've got a problem here. But I can paper over the problem here with this little bit of kit which you can buy.
Right. Oh, very interesting. So, but that, as we circle back then, and then we'll just have to save, if you'll pardon the expression, the meat of this for next, but that idea of the birth sac, that there are the ways that technology is in fact impacting the way people will be born. I guess I hadn't realized that was a market, because it seemed like that's not a problem. Getting born is not a problem. I mean,
problem for you because you're a man.
No. But tell me what you mean by that.
What I mean is that pregnancy for women, a most incredible, beautiful, amazing experience, but it also, in the world that we're living in now, it is one that takes a very, very big toll on you personally, mm-hmm. professionally, and physically. And it is, in many ways, the last big inequality between the sexes is in reproductive input. Men provide one cell, and women provide a lot more in order to kind of incubate the child. And there is a market, and people are very taboo. It's very taboo. People are very unwilling to talk about it, because it so goes to the heart of what makes a good woman and what makes a good mother, is that you have to be prepared to sacrifice your body in order to carry a baby in it. But there is a market for pregnancy-free parenthood for women, right, and for men. And that's where this technology has an application. I mean, there are many ways that this technology has an application. But of all the parts of the book that I wrote, this is the one that frightened me the most. It's a very, very powerful tool, which in the wrong hands could be used in very dark ways, I think.
Well, I want to pick up on that. And so let's just say for the moment, I want to make a counter argument on what I think would be a sexist male argument for what you're suggesting. And I also want to see if I can't catch you on maybe a little bit of a contradiction between what you just said there about birth and what we were talking earlier about when it came to relationships. And I'll leave it at that for the moment. But I know she can handle this, because she's 100 times the pro I am. Jenny Kleeman and Sex, Robots, and Vegan Meat. Your calls coming up in a half hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So this is where it leaves us. We've talked a lot about the sex robots, the vegan meat. We've talked about the death pod that's on the website if you go to coasttocoastam.com. But this is maybe the hardest one to talk about. The idea of technical innovations with regard to births. You know, everything's a trade-off. And sometimes when you mess with nature, we get repercussions that we can't anticipate. We'll talk more about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You can hook up with Jenny Kleeman's website by going to coasttocoastam.com. Find out more about her and all of her work there. So I'm like 100 years old, Jenny, and my wife and I have been married for 35, 36 years coming up. And we've got two young well, they're not young anymore. At one point, we had the halfway house of full-grown men, but now I've got fully adult males, and we all made sacrifices, right, to raise kids, and we decided what we were going to trade off to get them, and I that's why I was kind of chiming with when we were talking before about that idea of sex robots, not as a bridge to relationships, but as a barrier to relationships. It allows people to avoid the emotional commitment that it would take to be in a successful relationship. And it's much in the same way as we were talking about the death pod, that it sort of creates an easy out, right? I mean, it's sort of an escape hatch that it seems frivolous, especially when it seems to be built around a bunch of finer print on a contract so the manufacturers can't ever get sued or something. But I wondered that as I was contemplating the idea of birth, and then how we were talking about that just before the break, isn't it, when you said, you know, well, it's easy for me to say because I'm a male, when I was talking about the idea of some sort of alternate birth arrangement, but in some ways, isn't it kind of the same thing that it's what we're willing to invest. And if we cheapen the investment in it in terms of our time and our humanity, it'll change the success of the outcome. Where are you with that?
I would totally agree with that. I mean, the argument of the whole book is that we have to solve the problems that make us think we need these products rather than, right, than using the products. And the problem is that it is really difficult for women to be equal active members of society at the same time as being the ones that carry the babies. I mean, but the issue is the inequality in reproductive input. I mean, I am absolutely not advocating. I have two children of my own. I would not have grown them in a plastic bag. I'm very happy that I grew them inside my body. Hmm. But, you know, even though I had a successful career, I felt when I was pregnant that potentially I could be doing something really damaging to my career. I felt very judged. I felt constantly, I didn't know if I was doing the wrong thing. Was I eating the wrong food? Was I behaving in the wrong way?
Right.
Was I, you know, you, there's different piece of advice every week. Don't sit on plastic, you know, don't drink from plastic bottles. Don't sit
right
on furniture made of certain things. Can you, you know, the French drink wine once a week, but you know, should you not drink wine at all? If you're pregnant in Portugal, you can eat an unlimited amount of like ham and processed meat, but if in England, you're not supposed to do that at all. You know, it's a minefield,
right,
and you have to give up your body to the incubation of this other person. And part of being a good mother is showing that you're prepared to make those sacrifices. But what that means in practice is that you are bending over backwards constantly. And I think we have a society at the moment that doesn't make it easy to be the person carrying the baby. It doesn't help you. It doesn't accommodate pregnant people very well. And so that means that some people, I mean, in the book, I look at people at the moment who use surrogates for no medical reason. So there's no reason for them to have another woman carry their biological child. They just don't want to go through pregnancy. And not just because they don't want their bodies to be ruined, but there are women who run for political office who say, you know, I can't afford to be pregnant during this time. My life is too busy. I need to travel. You know, it is the last remaining undeniable inequality between the sexes. And until we make it a little bit easier for women to have babies and children, it is always going to be something that makes being an equal member of society difficult for women, because we have to do the gestation part.
Yeah, and that's all fair. I mean, my wife experienced all of those anxieties about, you know, food, bottles, all of that too. And for that matter, generally, you know, the shaming that she went through being pregnant out in public, and people would look at her and go, "Him? Really?" And so she had to put up with that as well. But I think that at the same time, now I'm just saying this because it's the middle of the night, so you know what the hey. But I think that was a growth period too, that without having that, anybody sacrifice, I mean, everybody loses out on that sacrifice. And I had to, I mean, I'm not comparing the body changes that my wife went through, but I think the sexist response to the idea of surrogates is I don't want my wife's body to no longer look like it's not a sex robot. I don't want the sagging boobs. I don't want, you know, the extra pounds. I don't want that. I want her to keep looking like this, and let's add a kid. And I think that's the way a lot of creepy guys will talk about it, frankly.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that's, I think guys have to make the adjustment that you stay committed to that, to that, you know, through all of those changes.
True.
And that's the growth thing for men.
I think that's very true, but there's also something really powerful that exists between women, which is
right.
the idea of having it all, having
right.
the family, having
totally.
The hot body, and having the amazing career.
Right.
And women are not very good at reflecting an image to other women of how difficult it is to have all of that. Particularly if you look on social media, or anywhere, it's this the idea of female success as projected by women for other women as well, is the idea of, look at me,
right.
I've got four kids, I've got this, you know, incredible body, and I'm really rich and doing well. And the thing is, it is almost impossible to have all of those things unless you have a team of nutritionists and plastic surgeons. And unless your full-time job is looking good, it's pretty much impossible. And, we have to give up on that idea because it's unfair to everybody. And equally, this whole idea of, you know, you talk about the sacrifice that women make with their bodies. We fetishize that sacrifice. We think that there's something
True.
Kind of magical about that, and that
sacred
leads to this. Yes, exactly. And that leads to this incredible connection that mothers have with their children, which a lot of people listening to this will think of as a completely natural, totally normal thing. Of course, there is that connection. But then if you accept that is the case, then you're saying that adopted children can never have that bond with their parents. You're saying that fathers can never have that same bond with their children. You know, I look at my kids now, and I would like to think that they're as bonded with their dad as they are with me. And I think there is something in our culture that says that we worship and romanticize this notion of the pregnant mother imbuing kids with some sort of special relationship, which we know can exist without pregnancy.
Yeah.
But I'm not advocating babies in a bag. Let me just say that again.
No. This is totally fair. But I'm smart enough to not totally commit to this argument. But I see a parallel between men with sex robots who are unwilling to make compromises too. They're trying to have it all, right? The career, their life, everything the way they want it. They don't have to make any compromises for anybody else. And they get the sexy, albeit plasticine wife. And that's the kind of idealized existence that they're making too. I think this is where, right? Too often we forget that it's right to have setbacks. It's good to have to recalculate.
The part of human nature is to have to compromise and adapt
right.
to changing circumstances. And all of these technologies assume that we're all quite selfish, quite greedy, quite incapable of change, that we're fixed. We have a fixed mindset where we believe that there is only one way that we're ever going to want to be, and that we're incapable of adapting. And
right.
And that's a view of human nature that I don't buy. I think human beings are amazing. We can change very radically. We can cope with a lot of unforeseen things that are thrown at us. And I think that view of human nature doesn't really do us justice in the end. But yeah, it's
yep.
all coming from the same place, which
yep.
is a place of kind of selfishness and greed.
Well, brilliant, wonderful. Let me ask you, though, if somebody's listening and they say, hey, I think I want a Jiffy Pop baby. I want to get a baby in a bag. Where do I go for that?
Well,
let's talk about that.
That of all the technologies I look at in the book, that is the one that is furthest away from being on the market, although it is going to be on the market. At the moment, doctors who are researching outcomes for super premature babies, how to make things better for very premature babies, have managed to grow lamb fetuses in bags not for the entire duration of the pregnancy, but for pretty much 50% of the pregnancy, the second half of the pregnancy. And at the moment, we know we can grow embryos, we can conceive test tube babies and grow them. And there is a kind of ethical limit that at the moment, most countries won't grow embryos beyond the 15-day mark because they've decided it's unethical to continue trying to grow them. But at some point, it will be scientifically possible, technologically possible, to grow a baby from conception to birth outside of the human body. And the obstacles to it are going to be legal and ethical rather than technological. This is going to exist at some point, though. At some point, pregnancy-free birth will be a possibility, but maybe not for at least a generation, probably a couple of generations, I'd say.
And don't you know there's going to be a bunch of people standing around in lab coats going, yeah, it smells like baby, but it's very mushy.
I think there'll be quite a lot of that. I don't want to be around to see the prototypes and where.
Yeah, so. Yeah. The island of Dr. Moreau kind of circumstances that it would take to even get there. I mean, it's interesting to think that maybe if there had been some sort of cataclysmic event in the future, and we were create artificial humans or lose the planet altogether or something. Maybe there's some market force that would do that. But just for the vanity of doing a designer baby and never having to either grow up or commit during the process of that baby's germination, I think that, or gestation, I guess, a better word, that would be, that I think that I just can't imagine the circumstances that would ever lead to that. There would be plenty of other options between here and there, right?
No, actually. I mean, the circumstances that would lead to it, and this is what makes this technology so potentially dangerous, is it's a very difficult thing to argue against. The circumstances that would lead to it is people saving ever more premature babies. So these are the most vulnerable human beings on Earth. The vast majority of disability now in the Western world is from people who have been born super premature, 23, 24 weeks. And this kind of artificial womb, externalized womb, what it does is it allows the baby to continue gestating outside the human body. At the moment, we have incubators which treat the baby like a newborn. They help the baby breathe, but they don't allow the process of gestation to continue. An artificial womb will allow the process of gestation to continue. And what's going to happen is there will be ever more premature babies who would otherwise die. And it is a very difficult ethical thing for you to say those babies should die when there's technology around that could save them. And that, I think the boundary is going to be pushed further and back, and younger babies being put into this kind of device until an externalized womb, an externalized pregnancy is entirely possible. And the thing that's really interesting is if the ethical argument for this technology is it's saving the most vulnerable babies on Earth, super premature babies, it doesn't take that much of a conceptual leap to say that the babies that are inside the bodies of women that are behaving inappropriately are vulnerable. Women who smoke, women who drink, women who eat the wrong cheese and drink from plastic bottles. Eventually, you know, you can think of a future where women who are behaving in an unmotherly way when they're pregnant will be told, we're going to have to end your pregnancy and we're going to transfer your fetus and put it into a bag for the rest of it because you're not behaving well. And that is a dark future.
That is a dark future. That is not inconceivable. I think maybe in a culture that always looks, if we create or attempt to reinforce a world that always sees government regulations or sees the a government driven by those types of impulses, I could see that we would do that. Hopefully, we would never be living in that black helmeted world, right, where people would be coming in and saying, you ate the wrong cheese last night, we're taking your baby.
We're already living in a world where there's a lot of, you know, we're almost there in many ways. I mean, in Alabama, there are a lot of women who are in prison at the moment for smoking marijuana when they're pregnant. And that's because it's defined as child abuse, what they're doing. Right. And so if technology like this was going to exist, say, you know, it's a difficult argument to make that you're saying that if you're saying that that's child abuse, then surely you need to remove a child from an abusive situation.
Yep. Nope. Totally get that. This is the stuff of dystopian nightmares and science fiction.
Bread and butter, yeah.
But maybe not. Do you see it differently in England as opposed to the United States?
Very interesting you say that. So in England, commercial surrogacy is not legal. We have altruistic surrogacy, but it's quite difficult to arrange. We have a national health service, so we don't have the commercialization of medical devices and medicines and things like that. I interviewed a fertility doctor in California who was saying how sorry he felt for us in Britain because we were so far behind and we would eventually catch up. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that we are taking things more slowly and being more circumspect. But I think across the world, it is very hard to make an argument that you don't want a technology to exist that's going to save very premature babies. And you know, just like in the US, women are having babies later and later in life. Pregnancies are much more precarious when women are giving birth later in life. There are more and more premature babies. So, I mean, the point of writing about this, I guess, was to have the conversations now before this technology arrives and make sure that it is only used for good. And there are lots of people who'd want to use it, you know, like trans women or gay couples who currently use surrogate. There are potentially positive applications for it, but before it exists, we really need to be able to define how we're going to use it.
Well, you state these concepts so beautifully, and I know that you're not just the author of the book on them, but you're a documentarian, so I guess your inevitable future is you'll be interviewing yourself coming up for your next documentary. I like this. That'd be a trick. I look forward to that. All right. Well, this is perfect. Thank you. What a great lead into our last hour. We're going to open up the phones. We'll give you all the numbers you need to join the conversation with Jenny Kleeman. Find out more about her by going to coasttocoastam.com. And you can go in either of those four directions, right? So birth, death, sex, food, and all the different technologies that are in our future. Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.